This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. 2 weeks after he was asked to resign, the future of Cincinnati City Manager Harry Black is still up in the air. What does that say about Manager Harry Black, Mayor John Cranley, and the ability of this council to work together going forward? A week ago, FC Cincinnati announced that they were no longer considering the West End site for their soccer stadium. But Wednesday, the Cincinnati Board of Education made an offer. Is the West End site on the edge of OTR still viable, or are the two parties talking past each other? Joining us to discuss this week's top local stories are Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, Enquirer political columnist Jason Williams, and Local 12 reporter Jeff Hirsch. But we begin this afternoon with WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner, who covered the decision of the University of Cincinnati to pay former campus police officer Ray Tenzing over $344,000. Tenzing, of course, was the officer who shot and killed Sam DeBose. Two trials ended in hung juries. If you would like to join the conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu. We are also on Twitter and Facebook. So, Tana, in this agreement, settlement, did UC admit that they had done anything wrong?
No, that never, nowhere in here does it. They say that they did anything wrong. No. Okay. So, but they, what Tenzing has said all along is that he was just straight up fired. And, you know, as a union member, part of the FOP, his contract entitled him to a pre-disciplinary hearing, which he says never happened.
And apparently it never did happen, right? The university doesn't defend that it – did the university learn anything from this, do you think? Is there something – that in the future they now know that they need to do before they fire in a situation like this?
Well, I mean, the university has a lot of good lawyers on their staff, so I think the argument could probably be made that they know pretty much about the law that they need to know.
Well, they know pretty much about the law, but they knew it before. So, you know, they dismissed him without a hearing. And in one sense, this agreement sort of was put in place through that sequence.
Yeah, right? They, nowhere in here do they say that they dismissed him without that. So I'm trying not to say anything that I don't have the actual facts written down for, Dan.
A lot of this has been done through statements. They've been very careful about what they've been saying about everything because, you know, it is a legal matter. I think if I could ask a question of this, I think the question would be, if you could go back, would you do it the same way or would you do it differently? And we don't know the answer to that, you know, but it really it could go either way.
That's why I'm asking the question of what's about the future.
This is simply my gut reaction. I think they would do it the exact same way in a second. What if they didn't? What could have happened?
Well, Tana, thank you for catching us up on this. And we're now going to move on to such simple things as the city manager and the mayor. And so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Last weekend, City Manager Harry Black and Mayor John Cranley seemed to agree on a brokered deal for 18 months' pay, about $423,000 for the manager to resign. But that deal can't pass unless a majority of council agrees, and they only have four votes for the deal, not five. Can't seem to count to five here. Is this ultimately, Jeff, just finding the right number? Or is there something else going on here, too?
I don't think the number makes any difference. I mean, in a sense that I think it's a political struggle in a lot of ways. If you look at it this way, so let's say $425,000 just for ease of numbers. If they fired him, which they don't have the votes for either, if they fired him, I guess it's 8 month severance, which I think is 175, give or take. So you're talking about a difference of, what's the math there, $250,000, right? So if you say you got to pay him $175 anyway, so now you're getting down to $250. And then if you hire outside counsel, if you can do that, that's not going to work for free. So whatever that is. So yeah, $250,000 spread, $400,000, yeah, it's a lot of money. But in a $1 billion-plus budget, which now is a deficit, but a bigger deficit. But in a $1 billion-plus deficit, you could argue that's kind of chump change.
This is not about money. This is about power. It all comes down to that. and what the charter allows everyone to do. I mean, this is what, you know, I brought this, you know, Greg Landsman. A lot of people this week thought he was going to be the swing vote. This
he
is
seems
where,
like he ought to be in the position to be the swing vote.
Definitely. And I guess he is because he said no. And ended up having to get pulled off the agenda of the approval of the settlement because the mayor did not have the votes. So, but I just thought, you know, he issued a statement and this is what he said. As for the shift in how decisions are made, let me be clear as possible. The city manager has to work with the mayor and city council, not just the mayor and not just council. The mayor has to work with council collaboratively, where we make decisions together and vice versa. That is what this is about.
Well, Jason, in a column that you wrote on Wednesday, you have a sentence that read, describing the five members of council who are opposed to this deal as ignominious, they have the ignominious distinction of being Cincinnati's most embarrassing team. You go on in that column to say that the mayor needs to be held accountable. But how isn't that what they're doing? How do you hold him accountable since he can't stand for election again? And, you know, he's not going away. He's been elected for 4 years. So, you know, isn't sort of picks up on Sharon. They're making their points here.
Well, I think all they're doing right. I mean, you've got to get Harry Black out the door because it's untenable between John Cranley and Harry Black. There's no turning back. You're going to have to pay him some kind of severance in addition to a study. And this study, despite what one council member said, is going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars at minimum.
Jeff's point.
Yeah. Yep. And so my thing is stop using Harry as a puppet in this whole thing to hold up the budget and try to use just go directly to Cranley and deal with him. You know, because really at the end of the day, like they don't have, like, it's just Harry doesn't have, you know, they don't have the votes to avoid a veto anyway. So I don't know why you just don't deal with the mayor directly and get Harry out of the middle of it.
Well, I can't imagine that 3 months from now, we've got Harry Black on one side of that office and John Cranley on the other side of that office. It's just incomprehensible.
You know what, though? I actually can. Because, you know, the city manager, when all of the media have asked him, like, how's it going? And he's like, I'm just focused on the work. And, you know, today he released the budget memo. This memo comes out, you know, every year around this time about all the different cuts that, you know, might have to be made. This is the same memo, same issues I've covered year after year. This is just like any other time, any other city business. He's working on the budget. And this is his proposed budget. I can't imagine a scenario where he's walking out the door within a month of having to put out the budget. So to me, and you know, the assistant city manager, Sheila Hill Christian, you know, she just left for a new job in the South. And it's like, it seems like an awkward time for someone to be leaving. And when Scott Stiles left the city after Milton Dahoney was, you know, after he resigned in a very similar fashion, resign or be
well,
fired.
John, the mayor, John Cranley, wanted him out. That was clear from the moment he was elected that
night. Right. And while he did leave with a settlement of his own worth $255,000, I might add, Scott ended up staying on. He was ready to go, but he stayed on through the budget because he knew about the budget.
Right.
Here's a weird irony. Well, there's so many of them. First of all, I think there could be a real great nighttime show called Day 23, Harry Black held hostage. That's how Nightline started. But there's a real irony here. If you go back to the campaign in the fall, in October, I remember one of the debates, and the question was asked. I think I asked it. Maybe I didn't. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back too much. But to Yvette Simpson and John Cranley, do you support the continuation of Harry Black as city manager? This is 6 months ago. John Cranley said, oh, yes, you know, he's doing a good job. I think he's good. I like him. We work together. And Yvette Simpson said, well, I would like to have a nationwide search for a city manager and Harry Black could reapply for his job. Well, that, you know, who would want to do that? Now, fast forward to now. The same people who were blasting Yvette Simpson for wanting to get rid of the city manager. I mean, yes, if she was in there now wanting to get rid of the city manager, a lot of those folks would be supporting her, and flip it the other way, those who supported Cranley back then would be opposing him now.
I think
so this is This is so political.
He would be gone. He would. That's, I talked. Sherry and I sit in the same little pod in the newsroom. And I was talking to her the other day. I said, "It's funny to think that this is all happening because if Yvette Simpson had become mayor, Harry Black would have been long gone by now."
But you know, I think too in that conversation, something that's very interesting. It's not even the mayor like speaking publicly in support of his city manager. You know, when it has come time for review processes, three of them, private reviews. And not a lot has been made public about them. He recommended raises for the city manager. You know, we are talking like December of 17, I think was the last one. And none of these things came up. I mean, the one thing where, I mean,
all the bad treatment he was supposedly giving city employees.
Right. So at this moment, I mean, what the mayor has said is, you know, he has seen a pattern of unprofessional behavior, not offered a lot of specifics about that, but certainly some of that's in the public domain. There's lawsuits about retaliation, right. You know, Dan Hills, there's a recorded phone call that brings into question some
and
things.
And my guess is those don't go away even if the manager goes away.
Correct. So there's a lot of things we already know. And Wendell Young is actually at council, was really calling for, you know, please tell us the specifics. Maybe that'll help us make a decision.
It's interesting because here's the issue. Like, they're going to do this study and you're going to find out that John's tough to work with and Harry's tough to work with. And the big thing right now is like, you already know all these issues. You've seen all these complaints and these lawsuits against Harry. These are the things. Like, the interesting thing, the people who are taking up for him right now have talked about none of that publicly. I haven't heard anything anyway publicly that they've addressed any of these actual issues.
I don't think it's about that.
No, it's not about that.
We're all saying the same thing. This is about politics. And joining us is WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhart. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email talk at WVXU. Well, Bill, let's move over to the FC Cincinnati situation for a moment. Not that these two things are totally separated, by the way. What did the school board really offer anything this week that wasn't new, that wasn't already on the table?
Not really. They did – last Friday they released their proposal for FC Cincinnati to build a stadium in the West End, swapping land and all of that. I think we're all familiar with that. And FC Cincinnati on Friday evening said, thanks, but no thanks. Never mind. We're going to look at Oakley and Newport. And so it seemed to be a dead deal, but school board wanted to go ahead and vote on it Wednesday because, as a couple of members said we were going to vote on it, so we're going to vote on it. There wasn't really much in the way of differences between their original offer and what they did vote on. They removed language about $250 million stadium value because they don't know how much a stadium would be valued at, so they had to kind of get rid of that. And then they help me out here, Jason. There was another minor change to it. It would allow a third party to make payments in lieu of taxes.
It could be the city. It could be the
city, Port Authority, 3CDC.
Okay.
Certainly that vote, though, while it didn't say anything technically new, it left the door open. You know, whenever the news was coming out that FC Cincinnati is like, okay, this is the money is not going to work. We're done. We're writing headlines in the newsroom. And I was like, somebody better add the word possible in there. Because with FC Cincinnati, you just never know. The deadline is the end of this month, March 31st.
That's the deadline number 8?
Yes.
The most recent deadline. It's the real deadline, I do think.
Possibly.
This whole thing has been kept alive by Cranley, and the whole third party is actually translated into the city and that he is working on his own package, or so we think. He is going to put a proposal together that the city helps pay for, pick up some of the slack in the taxes. Whether that happens or not, I just don't see anything like that flying at City Hall right now.
The school board's holding firm. They want the equivalent of 25% of what the taxes would have to be paid. And so the movement now, if there is going to be any, is going to have to be more money for the schools. They left the door open, but not for the deal that's on the table. To get to be all the way whole or so close to whole.
Now, there's one thing. At the school board meeting, there were no representatives from FC Cincinnati. And when I contacted one of their spokespeople and said, do these changes change anything for you? She said, what changes? They were obviously were not really paying attention to the school board. So
they're trying to indicate they've moved on.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think Jason alluded to it, too, that with the political dynamic at city council, with the mayor and the progressive five, as I guess you call them, could whatever the mayor comes in with, even if it's money falling from the sky to build a stadium, would he get the votes to do it? Yes, they voted to put it in Oakley, but you don't have the political history like you have in the West End, with the West End being sliced apart by the highway and all the political dynamics of that. And there's an awful lot of symbolism to this as to let's face it, rich white folks putting a stadium in a lower income African-American neighborhood. And that neighborhood's been, treated not so well in history.
Well, let's also make clear that site is right next to Over the Rhine, which has been invested in heavily by the power structure over the last 15, 18 years. So, it's a West End site, but right on the edge of Over the Rhine and complements Over the Rhine.
I think the let's not forget at this moment really is that this could go to Newport. And it's not won't be the first time things in the city, when things are being fought over, it goes to Newport. And I think, I discounted that for, several months, thinking this is going in Cincinnati. They're called FC Cincinnati. The Lindners are Cincinnati guys. And I just, at this point, I really do see a scenario where it could be going over to Newport.
If they put FC Cincinnati in Newport, FC stands for fairly close to Cincinnati.
What about I like KFC. I like Kentucky Football Club, KFC.
That's not to say that Newport is a bad site. I mean, there's a lot of positives about that. Our beautiful skyline will still be highlighted. But,
let's remember that in Pittsburgh, sports fans walk across the river, a bridge over the river, to get to their sports facilities. And I guess
they're all in Pittsburgh. Same state, though.
Same city.
Same city. But, it strikes me that the contrast here is Louisville, where Jerry Abramson, who truly is the best local politician I've ever met in my career, is mayor for life, supposedly. His point is he doesn't care where new development goes. It can be in Indiana. It can be in a county next to Jefferson County. He said, Louisville is going to benefit from this no matter what. And we just can't get past the fragmentation that if anything goes to northern Kentucky, somehow it's a loss for us.
You know what? And it will be. It'll be great for the banks. Those restaurants are screaming for customers still. We want that project to be successful. Jeff Birding himself helped create the banks, drew up the plans for it when he was on council. This could be really a huge catalyst for the banks. And certainly it's going to fill up Cincinnati hotel rooms.
I say it's if it goes to Newport, it's a win for the entire region, but it's an embarrassment for City Hall, per se, that it's on the city government level. It's that you let a $200 million privately funded stadium get out of your city.
Yeah, privately funded is the stadium, but there's a lot of public money that goes into it. And I don't think anything has ever – we haven't heard anything from the government in Newport over there. I don't think –
Kentucky legislature this session did pass a public-private partnership bill that I don't know all the details off the top of my head, but I can't help but wonder if that would apply toward a soccer stadium in Newport.
And certainly the chamber over there has really been a cheerleader. I mean, they're really emerging these last few weeks as they want this.
I think they're being it's from talking to some folks over there, is there's an intent. They're intentionally being quiet right now because they do not want to create this us versus them thing.
Well, unfortunately, I'm out of time, but I want to thank all of you for being here today. And by next week, will we have answers when we return? What's it like to be a White House correspondent covering the Trump administration? After the break, Marianne Selesnik talks with USA Today's Greg Corti. Some days it seems that the news out of the White House on a Monday is ancient history by Thursday. If it seems confusing from a distance, what's it like up close? WVXU's news director, Marianne Selesnik, recently spoke to USA Today White House reporter Greg Corti.
Hi, Gregory. How are you doing? Hello. Good to talk to you.
So you have gone from Cincinnati. You were a city hall reporter in Cincinnati and various other types of reporting in Cincinnati for a long time. But you've been in Washington now for 8 years. Let's start out comparing the two. How do you compare covering Cincinnati City Hall to covering the White House?
You know, a lot of it is actually pretty similar. You know, politicians are politicians wherever you go. And I covered Congress for 4 years. I really compared it to just a very large city council. But in other ways, the scale is different, and the access is different. You know, when I was a city hall reporter, I was used to being able to go into the mayor's office. It was Charlie Lucan at the time, and you know, I could put my feet up. I could have a long talk with him, and just sort of let him talk until he made news. And then when he saw me, you know, scribbling something in my notebook, he would know that he actually, you know, said something newsworthy. And I'd close my notebook, go back, write the story. Now, obviously, you know, at the White House, you don't get that kind of access with the President of the United States. Although with President Trump, you know, we get more access than I think people appreciate. He loves the photo op. He loves what we call the pool spray, where we can shout questions at him. But, you know, obviously there's many, many more reporters. There's hundreds of reporters covering the White House as opposed to a handful covering the city, covering City Hall. But, you know, the reporting is reporting, and it's in a lot of ways not that much different.
Well, you talk about the pool spray. That's kind of interesting, that whole shouting at the president. How often does he actually answer?
You know, it depends on the day, and sometimes you can kind of predict, you know, based on what the story of the day is, whether it's a question he's going to want to answer, whether he will actually engage on that. But, you know, I had a day where I happened to be one of the pool reporters in Bedminster, Bedminster, New Jersey, where he has a golf course and where he spent most of August on that so-called working vacation. He had two different pool sprays. Both of them were about half an hour long. I got about maybe four or five different questions in that day. And so if you catch him on a good day, you almost can't get him to stop talking.
Did you cover President Obama at all?
I did. I covered the last 2-3 years of the Obama administration.
So tell us, compare the two administrations. I think many people think they're wildly different, and I'm sure in some ways they are, but are there similarities as well?
They are wildly different, and it's not just personality, and it's not just politics. The whole rhythm and pace of the White House is different under President Trump than it was under President Obama. President Obama was extremely predictable. You could sort of set your watch by how they would roll things out. If they were going to roll out a policy, it's a very sort of methodical way of doing it with background briefings with senior administration officials and fact sheets and followed by a formal announcement. With President Trump, it's just a series of leaks. It's very undisciplined and uncoordinated. You know, Obama was always on message. You knew what the White House message of the day was because everyone was talking the same talking points. Remember from the 2008 campaign, he earned the nickname No Drama Obama. So it was very different than President Trump, where there's the leaking. And also, you know, the message of the day, everyone in the White House can be on the message of the day. Today we're going to talk about steel tariffs, and before you know it, the President of the United States himself is off message, tweeting about things like the Mueller investigation or the Russia phone call or whatever else has been going on this week. And so it's much, much more chaotic from a reporting standpoint, because there's, you know, any number of, you know, half dozen, maybe a dozen storylines going on each and every day at the Trump White House.
How do you prepare for all of that? I know you probably want to, you know, do some research, get some background on something that you know you're going to cover. And then when things all go off in the left turn in a different direction, how do you prepare to cover whatever comes up?
Yeah, that is a problem. And you know, every White House reporter develops little areas of expertise, sub-beats in terms of foreign policy or domestic policy or issue areas. But my friend Tamara Keith, who I'm sure you've spoken to, she's the NPR White House correspondent. When I joined the beat 4 years ago, the first thing she said to me was that, you know, White House reporting is like the highest level of general assignment reporting that you can aspire to. You know, a general assignment reporter is somebody who doesn't have a beat, who just kind of comes in and covers whatever news that happens that day. And that's often what it's like covering the White House, is that you may be prepared for what you think is going to happen, and then something else happens. And so being a journalist in a lot of ways is about being a quick study and getting up to speed on the issues. After 4 years, you start to kind of know what the issues are that the White House deals with from day to day. You have a basic working knowledge. But that's, again, that's what journalism is. It's about getting up to speed, learning whatever you can learn, and then telling your readers or listeners.
You mentioned about the president tweeting, and of course, we've never seen anything like this with any other president before that I'm aware of. Do you find that that is an unusual way to have to get your information from the president every day, or is that a more personal way that you feel you are hearing directly from the man in office?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's exactly it. That never before in human history have we had such direct, real-time access to the thought process of the leader of the free world in such an instantaneous way. And part of that is the technology, obviously, that Twitter is a platform that allows the president to do that. But it's also the president's personality, that he doesn't have a filter. That's what a lot of his supporters like about him, is that he says what's on his mind. He doesn't hold back. He isn't filtered. And so whatever he's watching on TV, whatever he's reading, he's responding to in a very sort of visceral way. And so it is, in a way, it is interesting. It gives us more insight than we ever would from his statements at these pool sprays or these sort of anodyne White House news releases, which really don't get into the thought process behind the policies. But there have been a lot of times where the president's tweets and the president's policies seem to be at odds with each other. There's sort of an institutional White House that has certain policies. There have been a number of bills, for example, where the president has almost seemed to be making a veto threat on Twitter at the same time as his White House was saying, no, the president supports this bill. And it's caused a lot of consternation on Capitol Hill trying to get a read of who speaks from the president. Is it his Twitter account? Is it what he says? Is it what the White House press secretary and the institutional White House says?
How do you report on that when there are so many conflictions there?
Yeah, it is a real challenge, and I think it's especially a challenge when we have all of these anonymous sources, especially in the stories on the palace intrigue at the White House, who's in, who's out, who's about to be fired. Last week we had any number of rumors about the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, being close to being fired, the Chief of Staff, John Kelly. Any number of cabinet secretaries have been in trouble lately. David Shulkin at the VA, Ben Carson at HUD, and then we have Scott Pruitt at the EPA. All of these, you know, are relying on anonymous sources, some of which are in conflict with each other. There was a report, as a matter of fact, that the Chief of Staff, John Kelly, had to call up Scott Pruitt to say, stop floating your own name for Attorney General, because there was a rumor out there that Trump would fire the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, and replace him with the EPA Director, Administrator Scott Pruitt. So, you know, it really is a soap opera. And without knowing who all of these anonymous sources are, I think it can be very difficult for the people to really figure out what's going on. In the case of last week, Rex Tillerson obviously was fired as Secretary of State. After that, none of the rumors ended up becoming true, because there's one guy who knows for sure who's going to get fired, and that's the President of the United States. Everything else is, you kind of have to take with a grain of salt, because there are agendas at play in the White House where there is strategic leaking from different factions within the White House, each trying to get the president's attention with some scrap of information or some rumor or some suggestion that he's going to take a particular course of action.
One of the other things to point out with the tweeting is that it comes at all hours of the day and night. As the White House correspondent for USA Today, do you find that you're worried that you have to be up all night because who knows what he's going to tweet?
I am lucky in that I have a colleague who gets up a lot earlier than I do, so that gives me time in the morning to get up, eat breakfast, get my daughter ready for school, and take her to school before I come in. I'm actually toying with this, building my own Trump Twitter alarm clock to wake me up in the morning whenever the president starts tweeting, so I know how the day's going to go. I'm actually building that. It's going to have a little fake snooze button, which I'm kind of proud of. The president can make news in 280 characters, and it is something that you have to be prepared for. You're right. It happens early in the morning. It can happen late at night, and it can happen on the weekends. Especially when you have a weekend where the president has some downtime, you almost brace for it that, here come the tweets. It is very much more. It's always been, but it's increasingly a 24/7 job just following what's coming out of the White House.
And that's certainly different from the Obama administration. Would you say weekends were quiet then or not?
Oh, yeah. Look, world events can always intrude on the presidency, and the president always has to be able to respond, and it is a demanding job. But, one thing I came to appreciate about President Obama, having covered him, is that despite having the biggest job in the world, he was a guy who, most days, got in at 8:30 or 9 o'clock. He used to talk about how he had the shortest commute in the world because he lived above the store. He could just walk over from the residence to the Oval Office. But then at the end of the day, unless he had some big speech or if he was traveling, he would leave at 6 o'clock so he could go and have dinner with his family, and then he would kick back and watch SportsCenter as he read over some policy papers. And so he was there was sort of a segmented work day to being president of the United States. President Trump has a different kind of a work day. He has what we've come to call executive time in the morning. He takes his presidential daily briefing much later than Obama did, gets started much later, but also is up earlier, watching Fox and Friends, tweeting out little tidbits, and often staying up late at night and tweeting as well. So, yeah, the schedule is a lot less predictable, and that's certainly taxing on not just, those who have to cover him, but those who have to work for him.
As a person who's certainly heard him criticize the media, the press, reporters that cover him, the fake news comments that he's making all the time, how do you deal with that day in and day out? Do you take any of that personally?
Absolutely not. I think, my perspective is always that, it's our job to be professionals and not take the bait on that. I think there are times when the president would like to draw us in to some kind of debate or some sort of mud fight. I think he wins when that happens. And so I sort of try to take the position that it's my job to pretty much take it and to continue to report on the White House and do it as professionally as I can.
So you have the daily press briefings every day with Sarah Huckabee Sanders?
Well, it was almost every day under President Obama. Under this administration, it is less than every day. It's maybe two or three times a week. It depends on whether the president's traveling, whether the president has, what kind of photo ops or other sort of opportunities the president has. So it's not as often as they used to be, and they're often shorter than they used to be. Josh Earnest, who was President Obama's press secretary when I covered him, would have these hour-long, sometimes more than hour-long briefings, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders keeps them to, sometimes 20 or 30 minutes.
Do you get much information that you can actually use out of those, or are those more, what is the use for them for the reporters?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think so many people see those briefings and watch those briefings and think that's the sum total of what it is to cover the White House, and if that were the case, then really we wouldn't have much to write about. There's usually very little news that we get out of those. They do serve their purpose. They are the one opportunity every day, or at least the days that they have them, to get the White House on the record on some issue. Very often when you there are White House officials who are accessible outside of the briefing, but very often they will not speak on the record. So it's an opportunity to get them on the record, on camera, taking a position on a bill that's coming up through Congress, on some world event, some political issue. So they do have their purpose, but they're part of my philosophy is a larger diet of information so that when you sit down to write the story, the quote from Sarah Huckabee Sanders from the briefing is just one part of it. I think, unfortunately, we've gotten to a point where now the briefing itself has become news. Most, if not all, of the cable news networks will break into programming to cover the entire briefing live from start to finish. And I think that's, I have mixed feelings about that. I think that's good from a transparency perspective. I think the American people can see the raw material of some of the reporting that reporters are using for their stories. On the other hand, it's often very kind of out of context. The official answer from the White House is usually only part of the story.
Well, do you find you get conflicting information there? It seems there are times that I don't watch them regularly, but when you'll hear Sarah Huckabee Sanders say something and the reporters will come back with, but that's not what we're hearing from other sources or from the White House in other places.
Oh, very often it's not what we heard from the White House the day before. And that's, a large part of what White House reporters do is sort of keep this index of their mind that's constantly evolving of what the White House position has been, what the president's position has been on any given issue dating back to the campaign. And I think one of the things we do is we are always looking for some sort of nuance of position that might be different in terms of willing to make a concession on a particular issue, on a particular bill, in order to get the votes to get it passed through Congress, or taking a harder line. That's a lot of what it is. And yeah, you're right. There are often conflicting accounts of what has happened. But, very often at the briefing and very often in Washington, it's one of the first things I learned when I got here is it's very easy to get an opinion out of someone. It's very, very difficult to get the facts out of someone. And so you have a lot of people talking, taking positions. It's extraordinarily difficult to just find out, what's happening.
Do you find that you have to fact check a lot?
That's an interesting question because, under President Obama, if he were to give a speech, I would come into covering that speech, it's skeptical as any reporter should be, but with an understanding that anything that the president says in a speech has been vetted through layers of speechwriters. They had an entire research department that after the speechwriters were done, they would meticulously fact-check the speech. So I would be on guard for spin, but again, with the presumption that they weren't making things up out of whole cloth. And with President Trump, I have to say he has not earned that presumption. Because very often when he talks off the cuff, he does make things up. And, one exhibit of that is the story that came out recently about his phone call with the Prime Minister of Canada, in which he made up some trade figures on the spot. He insists that even though he was making them up, they were right anyway. But he conceded that, he does... He very often talks from his gut and not his brain. I think he would be the first person to tell you this, is that he has these instincts of what he thinks or what he believes is right and is not as interested in the literal truth of the matter.
You talked about your mixed feelings with the press briefings being televised every day. Do you find that you have to be more on guard because you're being watched? When you ask a question, when they show the reporters, does it make your ability to ask questions or your, are you focused on other things than just asking questions because you're worried about how you're going to appear on television?
I don't worry about that. What I do worry about is if I'm working on something particularly sensitive, I'm very careful about the venue that I ask the question in. So if I have a question, maybe I've got a tip about something. I don't know if it's true or not. I'm still checking it out. I don't want to ask that question in a live setting where you're essentially asking a wife-beating question. When did you stop beating your wife? That's loaded with these kind of assumptions that may or may not be true. And so for those kinds of questions, I'll want to ask those privately in a way that they can say, look, that's not true, and we can prove it's not true. And then it's not a story, and then this, you know, the question never gets asked publicly if they can satisfy me that it didn't happen or it's not a story. So, if it's a particularly sensitive thing that, you know, once I get their answer, then I'll want to do some additional reporting, and so I don't want everyone else in that room to know what I'm working on. Those are the kinds of stories that are the kinds of questions that I'm reluctant to ask in a public setting. But otherwise, I think, look, if your question is fair and is based on some sort of factual assertion, what you are doing in that briefing many times is giving the White House a chance to respond to other stories going on, accusations, unfavorable news coverage they may be getting in the news cycle, allowing them to get their point of view across. And I don't think there should ever be a problem with that.
Tell us what it's like to travel with the president.
It is quite an operation. If you ever sort of can see it from behind the scenes, in addition to what you offer when the president travels is Air Force One, obviously. But before that, there are any number of I don't even know how many, maybe a half dozen C-130 cargo planes that get there in advance, that carry the entire motorcade. There's White House doctors and Secret Service and all sorts of advisors and advance people that travel with the president wherever he goes. When he travels domestically, it's a pretty large package. When he travels internationally, it's an even larger package. President Obama had a quip on his first foreign trip that he has the largest carbon footprint in the world, because of all of the machinery of the presidency that has to travel with him. So there's that. There's sort of a weird bubble, especially when you travel overseas, where you could be in an exotic location, but you're sort of trapped inside of this artificial protective shield around the president as a reporter. But as a reporter, it's also often very valuable, because when you're on the road with White House officials, you're always waiting for something to happen, or you have some downtime, and it gives you kind of access to White House officials that you might not get when you're at the White House every day.
Tell us about the building itself, the White House itself. I imagine, everybody hears about it from the time they're little. How did it feel to you the first time you walked in?
The first thing everybody says when they walk into the briefing room is that it's a lot smaller than they envision it from TV. And my hunch is that if you were to go to anywhere else in the White House, you would have pretty much the same reaction. The West Wing, especially, is extremely small. There are, the chief of staff, the president, obviously, the press secretary, the national security advisor. Some of those very top-level jobs have very nice, ornate offices. But, most mid-level policy advisors of the White House have very small offices. And if you are lower level, you are sharing a desk, or you are in a common area with a bunch of desks all crammed together. Because there are hundreds of people who work for the White House, and they're not making more real estate there. Now, most of the people who work for the president work across the street in the old executive office building, which is a gorgeous building, probably more beautiful than the White House itself. I love spending time over at the old executive office building. It's a former War Department building. But the residence itself is very small, but not very small, but it's maybe not as big as it looks, but also just full of history. I mean, every time you turn a corner, you see some piece of artwork, some history, painting, It's when you are working at the White House every day, you don't always fully appreciate it. You're thinking about, how am I going to write this story? What question am I going to ask? What do I have to do next? It only happens, usually for me, it's at night when I'm leaving, and I turn around and I look back at the White House, and I think, it's a pretty neat privilege to be able to work in this building every day.
Do you get to see much of it? Or are you mostly in the briefing room?
For the reporters, there are certain areas we can go. We come in the northwest gate of the White House, so it's on Pennsylvania Avenue. And then there is, as you pass what we call Pebble Beach, it's where all the TV cameras do their stand-up reports from the White House with the White House in the background. If you were to walk straight ahead, you'd go into the West Wing, but if you take a left, you go into the briefing room. And really, it's the briefing room and the press area behind the briefing room is where we work. We have access to what we call lower press, which is a group of offices of the assistant press secretaries. And we can walk up to Sarah Sanders' office. We can go to the press secretary's office. And that's about as far as they'll let us go in the West Wing without an escort. So everywhere else, either in the resident or the West Wing, we need some kind of an escort to go. So it's only for specific events that we get to go elsewhere. So we don't get to wander around a little bit. The one place we do go often is the South Lawn of the White House. Anytime the president comes or leaves by Marine One, by the helicopter, the press will assemble on the South Lawn in case he answers any questions on his way to the helicopter. But that's pretty much about it in terms of routine daily access.
As we're wrapping up, what's the best thing about your job?
I love being a reporter. I love journalism no matter what. The White House is a sort of a special beat, but, you know, sometimes I dream of just going back and covering City Hall. To me, the reporting is the reporting, the ability to tell stories, the ability to tell people something that they didn't know before. Again, that's a lot more challenging when you're at the White House because you have, you know, 200 or 300 reporters all chasing the same stories. But every once in a while, you get to expose an issue. You get to highlight something that people might not have known anymore, get people to focus on an issue that's like a real issue in people's lives. That part of it is incredibly rewarding, and I hope to be able to continue to do it as long as they'll let me.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's all good catching up with you as well.
And I get to see you this weekend, so we're happy you're going to be in town for the Cincinnati Society of Professional Journalists luncheon on Saturday. Thank you so much for that. I've been talking with USA Today White House correspondent Gregory Cordy. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Marianne Zalesnik.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer, Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned for Science Friday, coming up next.